All right, so we've been talking about culture. Just a reminder of how we got here to talk about culture. We're defining leadership as a leader with all of his strengths and all of his weaknesses, interacts with the culture of a place or a people or an organization, which basic definition is how we do things here. And he interacts with them in order to define a vision or a preferable future. And as he defines that preferable future with them, he gives them the impetus or the leadership in doing the planning and the praying and the strategizing on how to make that future a reality. So now we are into the idea of how do you learn the culture of a place. You've got to know where you are before you can know where you've got to go for a preferable future. And last time I introduced this this model here, espoused values, observable artifacts, and basic assumptions are those things that you'll see culture in. You'll be able to identify, oh yeah, that's who this group of people are. Now, it's very important. I told you the story of the pulpit in my previous church. That is an artifact. It was an artifact. It was something that was important, although I didn't know its importance. And so you've got to spend the time in order to get to know what are those important things that are part of the culture, that make up the culture. In fact, there's a story. I don't know if it's true or not, but the story of a United Methodist Wesleyan pastor who was sent to serve in a small church in a small rural town on the East Coast. And he went there, and he noted the first thing, he moved into the parsonage. They had a place for the pastor to live. And he noted that the church building had two entrances. That's all it had. And the one was mostly blocked by this fairly good-sized tree that was sitting out there. And the tree was so big that that door could hardly be used to get people in and out. And so he just thought, how stupid. Why didn't anybody cut this tree down before? And without asking anybody, without talking to anybody, he loved to do this sort of thing, owned his own chainsaw, so he got out there, cut down the tree. And it wasn't long before some people from the church stopped by, and they were horrified. Turns out that that tree was called the Wesley tree. And according to legend, John Wesley himself had planted that tree on one of his visits to the United States back in the 1700s. And so it was a very important artifact as far as identifying who they are. And because he didn't find the time or take the time to get to know that culture, he committed a major faux pas, and within a week he was out of there. The church would not stand for his presence there. That's the kind of thing about an artifact. It's something important. Espoused values. Now, espoused values, in other words, are the ones that are spoken. That's a little tricky because a few years ago in business, it was very important that you define your core values. And I'm going to walk you through a process in order to do that. But one of the challenges of defining your core values is that sometimes they go into a drawer somewhere and nobody reads them again. And so you have to ask, well, you know, what are your values in this place? And that's a fascinating thing. You'll do that. We'll do that with mission and vision statements as well. If you just go around and ask some people, what's your mission statement? And, you know, people wrote it down sometime, but they couldn't remember it at all. When I came to the church, I just completed serving. I said, okay, what are the values of this place? And they couldn't articulate them. What's the vision of this place? What's the mission of this place? Couldn't articulate them, even though they were written down somewhere, but they were written down and they were put aside. That often happens with values. And so values are in the process of changing all the time. And so how do you define what they are now? It's a very important thing to define what they are now. And then basic assumptions, underlying often unconscious things that determine an organization's attitudes, thought processes, and actions. These are the things that define a place, but they are assumptions about life. My one son-in-law is a structural engineer, and when he graduated from Washington University in St. Louis with his master's degree, he went to work for an organization that designed schools. And as a structural engineer, he was needed in that kind of situation. And so he went to work for this company that was owned by somebody in their 80s who was still working every day, 80-plus years old. And there were basic assumptions about how work should be conducted by the owner. And therefore, those values were filtered down to everybody in the organization. A value such as, an assumption rather, that you can't be trusted to put in your time. And so they had a 7:59 a.m. starting time in this business. And everybody was expected to be there at 7:59. And at 8 o'clock, 1 minute late, the doors were locked and you'd miss a day's pay if you didn't show up by 8 o'clock. Because it was assumed that you've got to be watched. And your break time was very carefully controlled and et cetera. Now for a millennial, that's a horrible thing to have happen to you. A dress was very important. They had a value on presenting themselves positively to their customers, but also to each other. And the chairman would talk about, you know, how you dress reflects you. And so every day they wore a suit, tie. That's how they worked. All those kind of restrictions in their life. Now, my son-in-law worked there for just a few months. And he was offered a job by another organization who understood the assumptions of a millennial. And so they gave him freedom to flex his time. In other words, he puts in his time at work, and he's got to make some time for meeting with other people on significant projects, but he sometimes starts work at 5:30 in the morning so that he can be home by the time the kids come home from school. So he's not on a clock. But he's understood that he's going to put in his time during that time. How he dresses, you know, as long as they're not meeting customers, he can dress fairly casually. It's kind of business casual, which is khakis or colored jeans or something like that, and a collared shirt. But it's a casual kind of setting where people are encouraged to interact with each other, and they do team building exercises to get to know each other and that sort of thing. But that starts with a basic assumption about what it's like, as we talked about last time, to work in a millennial generation, and those are the people that they want to attract. And so they created a value system that would allow people like that to feel comfortable there. Now, all of that goes into the culture. So espoused values, basic assumptions, observable artifacts. So how in the world do you go about finding what the culture is like where you are? Well, we're going to talk about learning a cultural process. First step is to listen. Just to listen to how people talk. Listen to what they talk about. Listen to how they handle conflict. If there is conflict, and maybe if there isn't, that says something about the organization as well. Maybe positively, maybe negatively. But listening to what is the language that this group uses? Is there laughter in the place? Now, it's not one of our value systems in our church, but one of the things we valued as a staff was the fact that we have fun together. We don't all go out and have fun. We have fun working together. We enjoy working together. And that comes through. And if somebody came in, that's one of the things. I had a consultant come in and help us with some staff things a few years back. And one of the things he says is, you know, people like to work here. There's a joy that infuses the place. You can find all that stuff out by listening. Secondly, do a values exercise. Now, there may be a written statement of values. Throw that out and start over again. Gather some leaders together, key leaders, and just begin to ask them questions. Like, you know, what are the ideal behaviors in this place? What does it mean to be a part of this organization? What does it mean to be part of this church? What is important to this church? And what is important to how people treat each other in this church? What kind of skills are needed in this organization in order to thrive? How do people fail in this organization? How do you deal with those sorts of things? How do you deal with each other? How do you relate? Just talk about those things and then say, what is really important? What defines who we are and what we are about? And what are our greatest strengths? That's just some of the key questions to ask with a group of leaders. And it's a fascinating thing what will come out. You'll come out with a listing of values that will be long and large because this is fun stuff for them to talk about. They're talking about their place. And you say, what is it? What is this place really all about? If you put that down in one phrase, what is it all about? Now, in the church that I've just finished serving, one of the joyous things I learned early on as I listened to people and then we actually did a values exercise is that the number one thing on our list was grace. That we would be a place of grace. Now, the church has not always been known to be a place of grace. In fact, many people in our congregation had been burned in previous churches where they'd gotten a divorce, and as a result, they were kind of blacklisted in the congregation, or they were, in one case, excommunicated in a previous church because they did this great sin. People who are struggling with sin were having a difficult time fitting in. You know, I told you about the John Fisher kind of situation where, you know, the 12 steps for the recovering Pharisee, that if you're part of a typical church in the United States, you know, you have to recognize you're a sinner to get in, but boy, you never admit any sin after that because, well, what would people say? And so as a result, we're not very much a place of grace. In fact, one of my powerful memories as a child was having a woman stand up in the congregation in a worship service. Now, she had to confess. Church leaders said this had to be a public confession. And it was a confession that she had committed a sin against the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. She was pregnant. She and her boyfriend had engaged in sexual intimacy. They were not married. And as a result, they made her stand up, which is, you know, that's a whole thing about that culture. It's an interesting culture. But the idea of grace then, there was forgiveness offered, but it was odd because so many people said, wait a minute, what about those who are greedy? What about those who are cheating in their business situation? What about? And so it was an odd feeling, but what I remember most as a small kid, tagging along with my mother, is that this poor woman, young woman, was standing by herself after the worship service. It was like nobody wanted to get near her because she was this admitted sinner, and maybe they were just uncomfortable that they didn't know what to say to her. My mother went to her, gave her a big hug, and I remember her saying, as I'm sitting next to her, 6 years old, something like that, saying, well, I guess it's just you two. It's just we two here. We're the sinners. And I didn't find out till almost 30 years later that my mother was pregnant when she got married. And so she understood what this woman was dealing with and was able to engage in it and offer her grace and forgiveness and love. Now, I've shared with you something about my failure in previous church. And when I came to this congregation, they lived out that value of grace. In other words, we're not going to judge people for where they have been or what they've done or what they're dealing with. Rather, we are going to be an avenue and channel of God's love and grace and mercy to people. And so we get people in that church who are dealing with drug addiction. We've got some who have conquered it, who've conquered alcohol addiction. We've got some who aren't. In fact, my wife, one Sunday was in the bathroom and came out and says, you know, somebody's been smoking marijuana in there. And she looked around and was able to identify who it was, at least fairly certain who it was, and said, well, they're here at least. We had a man who's got to do his funeral, but is an alcoholic and eventually drank himself to death, could never conquer that addiction of alcohol. But he could come to our church and he could be received and loved and he could be encouraged to do more. And on the other hand, we had a guy there who had gotten a 50-year pin from Alcoholics Anonymous because he was sober for 50 years. But he could come in and say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I fit here. I belong here. We had ex-convicts, people who had been in jail for sexual sins against children. And they could find a place there. Now, of course, we created a safety net for the children as far as interaction and all that sort of thing, but saying, we're all broken. We've all failed. We all sin. And so they said, grace. That's got to be number one on the list. After that, there came, you know, things like Bible teaching and a commitment to spiritual growth and discipleship and those sorts of things. But those kind of values, those are the things that come out. Who are we really at our core? What does it mean to be part of this congregation? Now, values come in two different styles. You should know that. There is a value that you state. Sometimes people will say it, but you know it's not true. It's an aspirational value. In other words, they wish it was true. Many, many years ago, I was working with a church, and they said, you know, we are a welcoming congregation. We are here, our value is to have people come in and we're going to enfold them. But then you look at their practices and you say, that's not your value. Because there was no place when people came in to identify them as visitors. There was no place they could go to get for information. There was nothing that was said to them. We found that there were people who met the people that they knew after the worship service. They wouldn't meet new people because they were just comfortable with those new people. And we found that the community we were in was fairly middle to lower middle class, and yet the church was upper middle class. And so you've got Cadillacs and Lexus cars in the parking lot and big SUVs that are fairly new, and somebody coming in an old jalopy didn't fit, et cetera, et cetera. And so and they had this horrible designation. They'd had some people join the church, but one of the things they would say about them is say, oh, that's a community person. In other words, it's not really us, but a community person, a project, somebody to work on, to hopefully make him like him or her like us. And so it was a good value, and they made some powerful changes in order to address those issues. But when somebody said that, you know, our value is welcoming people, and as they started discussing it, they realized, wait a minute, that's not really our value. You know, our value is feeling safe. Our value is feeling comfortable, and if these people come in, we'll be nice to them. But it isn't letting them come in and fit. And yet, you know, they made the changes necessary, and they were able to do it. So aspirational and real values, sometimes that becomes a definition that you've got to work with as you work through values. Somebody will say something and the group will have to discuss, is that really a value? So you do the values exercise. You get people together. You talk about who are we really? What are we really about here as a congregation? What is the essence of who we are? What would it be like to fail here? What is that? What are our greatest strengths? Then you take those values and you group them. For instance, if you get a bunch of values that are alike, like honesty, you know, we're committed to being honest with each other, or we're committed to have integrity with each other, we're committed to treating each other respectfully, etc. You might put all those under a rubric of truthful or something like that. You try to group them and define the central, group them into similar areas so that you don't have 400 on the list. And then you define the central themes. What is essential? What's unique about us? What makes us who we are? So that's the next step. Then you create the list. And you come back with the same group of people. And you check and say, is this true? Is this what we said? And then when they agree and they prioritize them in some way, then you word them well. You try to find an interesting way to word them so that they will be memorable for people. For instance, the one that's listed there, deliver wow through service, is Zappos' value statement. Their number one value statement is that they are about service. They are about serving you. They only sell online. They don't have a store. But they're going to create a wow experience through service. Now, that creates an image, right? And you know that if you deal with Zappos, you can expect high quality service because that's who they are at their core, the core of their being. And it's that kind of thing. You word them well, and you word them in ways that evoke emotion, that tie you into people's feelings. You know, when we get into change processes, we're going to find that feelings of people are very important when you're trying to create change, because people will go with their feelings more than they will go with their reason. And so in wording a value statement, you have to create something that creates that kind of sense of, oh, I can connect with that. Like even using a word like wow in a value statement is important, because it says, yeah, this is exciting. It's exciting to do it. And if you were working at Zappos, you know that's what you're about. This is what we're doing. So that's all part of the value process. And you put them to the test. You try it out with a larger group, not just the key leaders now, but with others. You begin to maybe do some focus groups, or you invite people in, or you go to people or send your elders or leaders out to meet with various people in small groups, if your church does small groups, to talk about, hey, we've been talking about this. What do you think? Is this true of us? And then take their information back and write them out. And so that's a process to create a values list. What are your core values? Who are you at the core of your being? So, you listen, you do a values exercise, and then do a culture walk. You know, how is space allocated? Who gets what office and why? What's the signage like? What is assumed about the people who would come into your business or be served by your business or come into your church or be served by your church? The problem is in doing this is that sometimes we get very comfortable where we are. Andy Stanley, a church leader at North Point Church in Georgia, says that you know it's kind of like an old couch. If you live in the house and you have this old couch, you just become so comfortable with it, that's who you are. That's how you live. It's your couch. You don't even notice that it's getting old. You don't even notice that it's getting ratty because it's just been there. It's been there forever. I had some of that experience when I went to the church I served first in California, the first building, and we got a group of people starting to think about culture. And one of the things they did is they walked into our worship area. Now, there were a lot of assumptions made by those who had built that building back in 1971. One of their assumptions was that they never wanted to grow bigger than 450 people. And so that would be about 100 to 150 families could meet in that church. And so they designed the building so that it couldn't be grown beyond that. We had three different architects try to create a way to effectively expand that building before we decided to relocate. And they planned well. The idea was, well, once they got that big, that's all they wanted to do, and other churches could start, but that's what they were going to do. And so there was that assumption. There was an assumption that if you came in, you didn't really care how things looked. And so the walls were just like cinder block, plain cinder block going around, and nothing fancy about them all. And they had a wonderful statement in the dedication ceremony that I found in a file, and that was that you know that rough brick just reflects the roughness of who we are. But the reality was they were cheap, at least that's my interpretation. And so that was an assumption. They had an assumption about the pews. The church was built in a time when orange was popular color. I had a friend come in to walk through, and he said, "Whoa, look at this! It was kind of dirt brown carpeting and pews with a bright orange kind of covering. They were comfortable, but bright orange." And I was told by this person I had invited in, who had some knowledge of how you do this sort of thing, and he said, "You know, that color orange was popular in 1971 and 1972. That's it. So anybody who walks in who's not aware of that color, who's not aware of who we are beyond seeing what we are, discerns some values there. And the value is that we're really going to just be ourselves, and we aren't going to do a thing to make you feel more welcome. We aren't going to do a thing to make you feel relevant." Turns out our sound equipment was just a horrendous thing for people who came with large sound equipment. In fact, as one person put it, you know, the Beatles had better... We had better sound systems in our homes at that time than the Beatles recorded their most famous songs on. And you come into our church and the sound system was terrible. And so the underlying assumption is this church is for us. It's comfortable for us. It's not for people who come in. And so there are all these kind of assumptions that we had to walk through. We said we're about welcoming people, similar to the church I described earlier. But if you walked in, you wouldn't find a sign anywhere that would tell you where are the bathrooms, where do you bring children. If you came in with three children, where do you go with those children? How do you get those children checked into the appropriate age group class? You know, what's going to happen in worship? How is that? There are all kinds of assumptions that we were about welcoming people when we weren't. And so we had to go through this values exercise of creating the values and then listening to people, but also doing the culture walk to say, wow, now that we've got some of these values defined, is that lived out in the way we use our space? Is it lived out in the way we create things here? What is important? And so that became part of the plans. And then it's just a picture of the church I just completed serving. Now, you know, if I could be with you, that's the disadvantage of doing these classes online like this. If I could be with you, maybe meeting in a church, we would take a walk. a culture walk and say, what do we know about this particular church, this particular congregation, as a result of simply looking at their space and what they do within their space? This is the entryway to the church I just completed serving. Now, there are several things that you will notice about the values of that congregation. One is, you'll notice it's a cement floor. There's no carpeting. And so there's a value on being simple. And, you might call it cheap, but I know from serving that congregation for 11 years that it was being simple. If you walked into the worship center, you'd find a cement floor, and you'd find plastic chairs that we sit on for worship. Now, the idea there was we wanted to create a place where anyone could feel welcome. You didn't have to create a beautiful spot for people. It was functionally very attractive, and in our culture now that's changing, turned out it's very attractive to have this old brick. But this was an old piano factory. And so you come in, you find a wide open space, and if you came in on a Sunday morning at about 8:30, you'd find people starting to gather. You'd find people praying with each other and for each other. You'd find coffee on, and there's an atmosphere as the worship team is practicing, and there's a sense of, yeah, it's good to be here. You'd find here no signage. Apparently the signage was removed. I don't know if this was a special event that day. But you'll notice the reference to our mission statement, which is taking the next step. Our mission statement, which we'll get into later, is, you know, we exist to encourage each other, to help each other take the next step in our relationship with Jesus Christ. And so things were used to refer to that, signage like that, preparing the upper rooms. I think this was a Bible school experience where we had kids in, and so that idea of working in the upper room, that where Jesus had his last meal with his disciples, so this is probably a message that was given to kids in their situation on that communion kind of experience of the Last Supper, the Lord's Supper. You'll notice that that the beams are just beams. The heating ducts are obviously visual. You'll notice there are some tables out with material on them. If you went just to the left of this picture, you would find our welcome area. We have a large section there. It's a large booth, and there are trained people in there, and there are people that are ready to help you with that, whatever question you might ask. We do have signage that exists on poles in various places, but later, after this picture was taken, we put in some stuff because our second floor is a youth ministry area. And so our skilled men in the church built an arrow that flashes, that goes up. It says, you know, youth, middle school, high school, are up here, up here, up here. And it flashes all along that stairwell that you see there. That stairwell was added during one of our expansion experiences, and it's made out of the beams of one of those old buildings that was nearby that was torn down, and we managed to rescue the beams so that we could have a similar kind of experience. So just an idea of a culture walk. It's very little, but it's that kind of thing you start looking for. What are important? What is important to the people who are here? So you do the culture walk, then also culture interviews. You learn the history of people. Get some of those people together and hear the stories. You know, who are the heroes in this place? Who are the people who made this place what it is? What are significant events in the life of this place? I used to do an exercise where I would give people just a quick outline of the history of the church, and did this in retreats several times and consulting kind of situations as well, and had them write very quickly a short life history of that church. And they often go with the pastors who are the pastors, but other than that, they'll deal with crises except for the beginning. Wow, how did this begin? And what was the vision that this church began with? Who lives it out? Church I just served, it was an incredible statement that they started together because they saw that there weren't churches in the community where anyone could feel welcome. And so they decided that they were going to create that church. They started out in a room in the YMCA that they rented every week. And when the YMCA couldn't let them in or couldn't continue to accommodate them on a Sunday morning, they ended up renting in this decrepit old building that was the piano factory. They rented from the owner. And the place was in such bad condition that when it would rain, it would leak water down from the third floor down to the first floor, and so they'd have pails collecting the water during their worship services with washcloths in the pails so that they wouldn't make a plink, 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 plink noise when the raindrops would drop in there. And they tell these stories. But they tell the story of the heroes, that first pastor who came and just went the extra mile to make things happen, about some of the original members who were just passionate about receiving anyone at any time who could have a vast variety of ages in the group, as well as life experience, as well as socioeconomic level, as far as racial level, racial experience, ethnic background, all of that. How do you create that? And you heard about the heroes of those kind of situations. And I've become part of that history. If you were to come to that church today, they would tell you something about when I came, because it was a miraculous story of how God called me into that congregation at that time. And so history. To ask questions of people as you get them, not the key leaders necessarily, but anybody in the congregation who's been there a long time, what would you say? What would you say are the most important events in the life of this church? What would you say this church is all about? What would you change? If you could change one thing about this church, what would it be? What kind of people fail to fit in here? Just to do culture interviews like that. You do those things, and you're going to have a pretty good idea about what the culture of the organization is. Now, last year, we realized that we had become a little loose with affirming our values. And so I took the staff through a process of talking about what are going to be our staff values. Now, we had a staff of 20, 21, 22 people at various times during the year. And so we got them together, and we just had a conversation using this process, these steps. And then I would take them each time and come. It took several months, but I would take what we had talked about, and I would go back and reformulate it and come back, and then I'd talk with the people in worship and arts because they were much more creative than I. And just want to show you as an example the results. Here are the values at Covenant Life Church of the staff. One is we take it personally. In other words, we're going to give our best to minister to the CLC family. We have a commitment to the mission of CLC, and we are living that out in our own lives. Now, this becomes a statement that becomes part of our evaluation process every year. How are you taking it personally? How are you living out the value of helping each other take, or the mission of helping each other take the next step in Jesus Christ? What steps have you taken in this past year to grow in your faith? We continuously grow is the second one. We evaluate regularly, and we're making improvements in our ministry, striving for excellence. So in other words, we don't just let ministries run, but every year we go through a process by which we evaluate those ministries, and we want to grow our ministries toward excellence. We collaborate. We see ministry as a team effort, and we'll go beyond our job description to serve and to help each other succeed. And so when we have budget discussions, it's not about, if you get that much, then I can't have as much for my ministry. It's what are we doing together? Let's talk about the big picture and what ministry do we have together, and what does that mean to have ministry together? And one of the questions we ask at evaluation time is simply, when have you served somebody else on staff? When have you engaged in their ministry? When has the worship guy been helping out in our children's ministry? When have other people been helping out in worship, help out the worship ministry when there was some big event going on? Humility is key. We're not competing with each other. It's not our agenda that is important, but it's God's agenda that's important. And so part of our key value is humility. And we talk about how do we live that out, because it's tough, because sometimes we like to be the ones who get the attention. And we're saying, no, we're not going to do that. It's our value, slightly an aspirational value, but it's our value that we call ourselves back to. We focus outward. We'll keep in mind the 16,000 people in our immediate area that are unchurched as we plan and pray. So we don't want to become ingrown, but we always want to be doing things that focus on the fact that people need to know Jesus Christ in our immediate community. And we value grace together. As we value grace in the church, we will treat each other with respect, forgiveness, and care. And we've had opportunities, many opportunities, to live that out, as we've had staff members who had major moral failures, and yet we were able to treat them with grace, and in many cases, not all, restore them to ministry over a period of time, because we got to see them responding to God's grace in a positive way, and our grace as well. So that's an important part of defining your culture. You know, learn the values, learn the history, learn the experiences that the church has been through that has made it what it is. Look at the physical structure and see who they are and how the essence of who they are is lived out and how they allocate space. And you'll be a long way down the leadership path. Next time, we're going to talk a little bit about creating your own personal set of values. And it's kind of an aside from this leadership discussion, but an important one because your personal value system has to mesh with the value system of the organization that you work in or work with. And so next time, that's the agenda. See you then.